and his guts. If there were ever a time he needed Simon's special abilities, it was now. But Simon was lost to him, locked away in the fearful mind of an eight-year-old boy, a little boy waiting to feel the cool touch of his mother's soothing hand, a touch that would never come. Lucifer kept to the shadows. The fates were smiling upon him. The footpath had led to the perfect place to leave the van, a small car park beside some tennis courts, dark, unused, surrounded by trees, perfect. He had left the van in the corner of the car park, reversed it close to the footpath, while staying clear of the dim pool of light cast by the first of the small street lamps. He'd swapped his suit jacket for one of dark leather that absorbed the light. He had donned his black leather gloves, then reached into the back of the van to take what he would need. A small crowbar to gain entry, a gag, some black plastic ties, a telescopic security baton, and of course, his pistol, a handful of lightning that made it all so easy. Lightning for the angel, baton for the witness. That would be more than enough. Now he padded down the path, keeping to the side where the widely spaced lamps did not reach. A vast shadow moving through the lesser shadows of the night, moving with stealth and purpose, doing what he had done a dozen times and more, doing what he'd been called to do, to seek out those who spoke untruths, and to silence them. "Psychic," said Detective Inspector Hunt. "Yes," said Steve, with a deep sigh of annoyance.
"Like Uri Geller?"
asked Detective Inspector Regan. "No," said Steve, trying to retain his composure. "Not like Uri Geller. Simon is the real thing, a genuine psychic." The two plainclothes CID officers had arrived a few minutes earlier, and it was clear that neither of them considered this a worthwhile use of their time. Now they stood in Simon's living room, looking down at him, and even Steve could read their minds.
"So what makes you think it was the killer?" asked D.I. Hunt.
"It was Simon's reaction," said Steve, "and the exit sign, TIX and the number 3. Steve raised a hand to his forehead. He knew how this sounded. He wished that Simon were coherent. He could convince them in a second. "And he fitted Simon's description," Steve added futilely.
"So Simon had seen him before?" asked D.I. Hunt.
"Not exactly," replied Steve, the sinking feeling getting stronger as he spoke. "Simon has visions," he said wearily. "Glimpses of the future, of other places." The inspectors looked as if they'd heard enough. "He had an impression of this guy, a big guy, like a giant, with eyes so dark they're almost black."
"And that's the best description you can give us?" asked D.I. Regan.
"No," said Steve, with more excitement in his voice. "I've seen him. I can tell you what he looks like." The inspectors continued to look at him, but Steve noticed that neither of them so much as reached for a notebook.
"He's big," said Steve. "I mean really big. 6'7", 6'8", and well-built. Must be 19 or 20 stone.
They looked at him now as if he were exaggerating, and D.I. Regan actually started moving towards the door.
"He's good-looking, too, in a scary kind of way," persisted Steve. "Strong jaw, dark eyes, heavy forehead."
D.I. Hunt lowered his eyes.
"Dark hair," said Steve, doggedly refusing to let them write him off as a crank.
"Long," he added.
"But he had it smoothed back with grease or wax, and he wore a suit," he concluded. "A smart blue suit."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Brennus," said D.I. Hunt, "but in the absence of any actual evidence to suggest this man might be the killer, there's really nothing we can do." Steve ground his teeth against the frustration. He looked down at Simon, but Simon had started to rock slightly in his chair.
"He's coming. He's coming. He's coming," he whispered over and over.
"That's not helping our case," thought Steve bitterly.
"Your friend really does seem to be in some distress," said D.I. Hunt. And it was the first time that Steve had heard anything like sympathy in his voice. Maybe you should call a doctor. So that's it, said Steve, ignoring the inspector's well-meaning advice. You're not going to do anything. As I said, said D.I. Hunt, there's nothing we can do. You could call Chief Constable McCormack at Bootle Street Police Station, said Steve. You can bet your ass he'll take Simon seriously. It's Sunday night, said D.I. Regan from the doorway. What do you want us to do, call him at home? Damn right, said Steve, his voice rising to a shout. D.I. Hunt raised a calming hand. We'll call him in the morning, he said. If he supports what you're saying, then we'll call back tomorrow. Tomorrow might be too late, said Steve. That's the best we can do. So you're going to just let the killer go free? Challenged Steve. The inspectors gave him an unpleasant look. Let him go free to kill again, Steve followed them out of the room as they headed for the stairs. Well, you won't have to wait long, he called after them. In fact, you should be finding another body soon. The inspectors started down the stairs. That's right, Steve went on. Another tortured body. Only this poor bastard has been crucified. The inspectors stopped. They turned. They looked back up at Steve with an intensity that had been sadly lacking till now. What did you say? Lucifer had seen them arrive. The pawns of so-called justice. One big, one small. He'd ventured round the house to watch them enter to make sure, but the guardian angel had opened the door and let them in. There was no doubt, this complicated thing, that three was an awkward number to handle. He would consult the chorus, ask for guidance, find a way. Should he wait? No, the pawns might remove the witness to a more secure place. Should he leave? The chorus would not hear of it. He must take the witness tonight. He must take the witness now. Lucifer crouched in the shadows, but the noise coming from the house next door made it difficult to think. The sounds of debauchery flooding out into the street. He looked across at the bikes, packed onto the drive, and lined up along the curb. A row of bikes, and then the angel's car. A row of bikes, and then the angel's car. That might do it. Yes, that should be enough. Lucifer checked to see that the road was clear. Then, leaving the shadows, he approached the bikes. How did you know the latest victim had been crucified? Asked D.I. Hunt. No one knows about that. They were back in Simon's living room. Only now the mood had changed. Where before there had been apathy and impatience, now there was heightened interest and something Steve should have anticipated, suspicion. I've already told you, he said, nodding towards Simon. It's Simon. He sees things. Still, the inspectors hesitated. He experiences the deaths. What do you mean? Asked D.I. Hunt. He feels what the victims are feeling, said Steve, thinking back to those harrowing attacks. He has done for 16 years. The inspectors looked back at Simon's huddled form. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. Simon continued to whisper over and over. Steve could see they were struggling to accept what he was telling them. Who would not? But they no longer gave him the impression that he was wasting police time. They turned back to Steve. Where were you on the night of Wednesday the 2nd of March? Asked D.I. Regan. Oh, for fuck's sake, thought Steve, putting his head in his hands. Last Wednesday night, said D.I. Hunt. Where were you? Flying out to Florida, growled Steve with growing annoyance. With him. He stabbed his finger at Simon as he got to his feet. There's no reason to get angry, Mr. Brennus, said D.I. Regan. There is every reason to get angry, you pompous twat, stormed Steve. I called you guys for help, to help you catch a psychopathic serial killer, and all you can do is... Steve reined in his temper and turned away from the inspectors. Do you really think I would call the police if I had anything to do with these murders? He said. Wouldn't be the first time, said D.I. Regan. Steve rounded on the annoying police officer, but before he could say anything else, He was interrupted by the sound of a car alarm, a very familiar car alarm. D.I. Hunt moved to the window. "Is that your BMW?" he asked. "Yes," said Steve, crossing quickly to the window. D.I. Hunt nodded down to the car and the row of bikes that had fallen like dominoes towards it.
"Oh, shit," cursed Steve.
The last bike in the row had fallen heavily against his car, the handlebars wedged firmly in the BMW's radiator grill.
"I think you'd better move it before your neighbours hear the alarm," said D.I. Hunt. "Unless you want to knock on their door and ask for their insurance details."
"It's not my sodding fault," protested Steve, but he knew the inspector was right. A horde of drunken bikers might not be the most rational of folk, especially when their beloved bikes had just been trashed. He strode towards the stairs but stopped when the two inspectors made to follow him.
"Someone needs to stay with Simon," he said.
"I'll stay," said D.I. Regan. But Steve was not happy about that.
"No offense," he said, "but this guy's twice your size. I'd rather you stayed."
Steve looked to D.I. Hunt, who was a heavy-set man, a fraction taller than Steve's 6'2", a far more formidable prospect than the diminutive D.I. Regan. D.I. Hunt gave Regan a nod to send him on his way, and Steve ran down the stairs. Back in Simon's living room, D.I. Hunt looked down through the large bay window, a mobile phone held to his ear.
"Control, this is D.I. Hunt at 74 Freshfield Road, Altrincham." There was a pause. "You have any uniforms in the area? I've got a feeling we're going to need them."
Another pause.
"Good," said D.I. Hunt. "Quick as you can, Control." He hung up.
Lucifer watched as the angel appeared with one of the pawns. That would do. That left just one of the pawns between him and the witness. It was the bigger one of the two, although still far smaller than he. And besides, he held the lightning in his fist. Steve killed the alarm while he was still on the driveway, and after the briefest examination of the damage to his car, he went straight for the driver's door. The radiator grill was smashed, but the bike should pull free easily enough. He climbed into the car, but as he did so, the sound of music and raucous laughter from the house next door grew suddenly louder as the front door opened. One of the revelers stumbled outside, fumbling with his flies and heading towards a row of bushes. Steve started the car and put it into reverse. Lucifer moved quickly round to the rear of the house, to the fire escape that climbed up the back of the building. He took the metal steps three at a time until he stood at the fire exit door. He tried his crowbar between the door and the frame, but the lock was solid. He would need to give it some force. The glass would probably break. It could not be helped. Besides, the racket from the bacchanals next door might be enough to cover the sound. Lucifer set the point of his crowbar and leaned his weight against it. The door resisted. He gave it a wrench. There was the sound of breaking glass, and Lucifer passed within. Standing on the pavement, D.I. Regan winced at the unpleasant sound of screeching metal as the bike was dragged for several feet before coming free.
"What the fuck's going on here?"
cried a slurred voice from the driveway next door. D.I. Regan took out his ID and went to intercept the drunken biker, who seemed to be sobering up rapidly as he surveyed the row of toppled bikes. He turned back to the house, and before D.I. Regan could stop him, he'd called out in a night-splitting shout.
"Hey, guys! Someone's been fucking with the bikes!"
Bodies appeared in the doorway, faces peered out from the windows, and as Steve got out of the car, the din of heavy metal music ceased. D.I. Hunt turned away from the window. Was that the sound of glass breaking? He started across the room, drawing level with Simon, who was still sitting hunched in the chair. A spasm of trepidation gripped the inspector's bowels, a sudden feeling of fear, not helped by Simon's chanting.
"He's coming! He's coming! He's coming!"
He stared at the doorway, straining for any further sounds, sounds of an intruder. Nothing. Still, he'd better take a look just in case.
I'm just going to... He turned back to Simon, but Simon was no longer in his chair. D.I. Hunt jumped with fright. Simon was standing beside him.
Jesus, said D.I. Hunt. You frightened the shit out of me.
But Simon did not respond. He was looking straight through the inspector to the gaping doorway of his living room. Simon had stopped his chanting, but D.I. Hunt found the silence even more unnerving. Then Simon spoke again.
He's here.
D.I. Hunt spun around as a huge shape loomed like a demon in the doorway. He reached for his mobile phone, turned to look for a weapon, another exit, anything. Too late. The vast demon ducked into the room, the black sheen of a pistol held level at his waist. D.I. Hunt had chance for a single word.
Police!
He gasped, as the lightning struck him down. Everything happened so quickly. Steve got out of the car and started back towards the house. He did not want to leave Simon for a moment longer than was necessary. But the bikers had different ideas. The one who had raised the alarm walked around D.I. Regan to confront Steve just as 7 or 8 more came striding down the drive.
What the hell?
Came the common response when they saw their bikes sprawling across the road.
Let's just stay calm, said D.I. Regan, but his voice lacked any real conviction.
The bikers began to converge on Steve, and a police car appeared at the end of the road, its flashing blue lights illuminating the trees as it came quickly towards them.
"Where the fuck do you think you're going?"
asked the first biker, stepping directly in front of Steve.
"Back inside," said Steve,
making an attempt to move past the biker, but the biker would not let him pass. The biker grabbed his arm and Steve punched him squarely on the nose. He slumped to his knees as the police car pulled up beside the line of fallen bikes. Steve braced himself as the rest of the bikers started towards him. D.I. Regan did his best to slow the advancing bikers, but only succeeded in tackling one of them.
"It's him from yesterday,"
the man said as two uniformed officers leapt out of the police car and rushed to intervene.
"The one with a smart mouth."
A second police car turned into the road. Fists, feet, and angry faces lunged at Steve. He backed away, parrying anything that came too close, all the while trying to back away towards the house.
"You trashed our bikes,"
one of the bikers said.
"If I'd hit them, they would have fallen the other way, brainiac," said Steve.
The uniformed policemen were trying to get between Steve and the angry bikers. The adrenaline was rising. This was about to descend into a full-scale scrap. One of the bikers succeeded in grabbing hold of Steve. Steve grabbed the man's hand, twisted his wrist, and thrust him down to the floor.
"That's enough,"
said an authoritative voice, and Steve found himself being restrained by one of the new policemen who just arrived on the scene. Chaos reigned. The tension mounted. Steve had to get back to Simon. Lying on the floor, D.I. Hunt peered out through the pain in his skull. His entire body ached and he could barely move. His muscles kept twitching with uncontrollable spasms, and his heart was racing fit to burst. He turned on his side, peering around the room, but there was no one there, not the man called Simon nor the demon in the doorway. He fumbled for his mobile phone, but could not extricate it from the folds of his jacket. He tried to call out, but could manage little more than a harsh whisper. Regan was out front with the man, Steve Brennus. He had to warn them. He had to let them know. But the smallest movement was painful, and he could feel that he was about to faint. He looked around the floor for some way of alerting them. As his vision started to fade, his eyes settled on a mug of tea, sitting on the floor beside a nearby seat. D.I. Hunt reached out towards it, his trembling fist closed around it, the warm liquid sloshing over his hand. Then, with one last desperate act, he launched it towards the window. The policeman's forearm was across his throat and Steve's right arm was twisted up behind his back. One of the bikers took advantage of Steve's predicament and punched him in the face. Steve kicked the biker in the groin and the man went down with a grunt. Scuffles broke out all along the pavement as the uniformed police officers struggled to control the escalating violence. More bikers were emerging from the house, and Steve could hear the sound of approaching police sirens as additional units were called in to attend the scene. Then the sudden sound of breaking glass made everyone look up. Something had smashed into the bay window of Simon's flat. Steve watched as a large shard of glass fell out of the frame and shattered noisily on the driveway.
Simon!
Just calm down, said the policeman, holding Steve. But there was no time for rational explanation. Steve slammed his head back into the officer's face, and as the man relaxed his grip, Steve broke away and sprinted up the drive. D.I. Regan followed in his wake. Lucifer was elated. It had been easier than expected. The pawn had dropped into a twitching heap and the witness did not even struggle. He looked too frightened to call out, too frightened even to move. He just stood there, staring at the doorway as if he'd been expecting him. Lucifer had stepped up to him and felled him with a slap, a massive slap with his massive hand. Then he had tied the witness and gagged the witness and slung him over his shoulder. He seemed to weigh nothing at all as Lucifer carried him down the fire escape and off into the night. The chorus was singing, in an anticipation of a new confession. The night's devotions had only just begun. Steve charged up the stairs to Simon's flat and turned into the living room. D.I. Hunt was lying unconscious on the floor, two thin wires trailing from his chest. Steve looked up at Simon's chair, but the chair was empty. Simon was gone. Chapter 29. Steve raced through to the back of the house, to the door at the head of the fire escape. The door hung open, the frame splintered, the glass broken. He darted through and stood at the top of the fire escape, staring down into the dark expanse of the garden. Nothing.
God, Simon, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry.
Steve was almost paralyzed by the sense of guilt and failure.
Keep me safe,
Simon had said, and he'd failed. The killer had him. With an effort, Steve thrust aside these destructive thoughts. The killer could not have got far. He started down the fire escape and then he stopped. Something had caught his eye. Something moving down the footpath leading from this street to the next. A large, bulky, unnatural shape. The shape was keeping to the shadows, moving quickly. The killer. Steve's first instinct was to give chase, but his military training demanded a rapid assessment before he moved. Steve followed the line of the killer's flight to the car park beside the tennis courts. It was dark and empty, but Steve could just make out the shape of a black van tucked away in one corner. A black van. Steve's mind flashed back to earlier when they had arrived back at the flat. A black van had sidled past them on the road. A black van had followed them from the convention. Steve cursed his carelessness. The killer was halfway down the passageway. He would be in the van before Steve reached him. Steve had to get back to his car, and quick. Steve turned round and ran back through the flat. He met D.I. Regan in the hall.
What happened?
Asked the inspector, looking through the doorway into the living room.
Where's Simon?
The inspector made to stop him, but Simon could die at any time, and Steve would brook no further delay. He winded the inspector with a punch to the stomach and continued on his way. Back outside the house, the inevitable brawl was in full swing. More police had arrived, but still the bikers seemed in no mood to be placated. They scuffled and fought up and down the pavement, and no one noticed when Steve emerged. Steve ran straight to his car, and then he cursed again. He'd reversed right up to the inspector's car, and now a quarter ton of Harley-Davidson was sitting in his way. He was boxed in. He was just resolved to smash his way out when he heard a voice from beyond the inspector's car.
What's going on here, man?
Steve looked up to see another biker sitting astride an old Kawasaki Z1300. The biker had pulled up behind the inspector's car, beyond the press of police cars and the glare of the flashing blue lights.
"The brother's having a spot of bother with the filth?"
he asked Steve, turning off his engine and climbing off his bike. Steve looked at the biker, the wheels of his mind turning. The biker reached up to unclip the chin strap of his open-faced helmet, the keys for his bike still clutched in his leather-clad fist. And written across the front of his helmet, in bold white letters, was the biker's name, Spike. Steve slipped his car keys into his pocket and started towards Spike, who gave him a sudden, wary look. But it was too late. Steve punched Spike hard in the face, and as he dropped to the floor, he snatched the keys from his limp fingers. The sudden movement caught the attention of those still wrangling outside Simon's flat, and Spike's prostrate form drew concerned shouts from police and bikers alike. Steve ignored them. He climbed onto Spike's bike, turned the key, flicked out the pedal, and kick-started the Kawasaki into life. Then, as bikers and police rushed towards him, Steve revved the engine, but he did not head off down the road. Going round the block would waste yet more precious time. Instead, he spun the back wheel of the massive bike until he faced the pavement. Then he let out the clutch, mounted the pavement, and tore off along the pedestrian footpath down which the killer had fled. The footpath was narrow for such a big bike, and Steve was grateful that no one else was using it tonight. He was not driving with the greatest of care. What he needed now was speed. He shot out into the car park, and the bike wobbled dangerously as he skidded to a halt. But the car park was empty. There was no sign of the van. Steve emerged onto the road running parallel with Simon's. Still, nothing to be seen. Turning left would take the killer into a warren of cul-de-sacs and residential backstreets. He would be heading for more open roads. Steve turned right. The bike growled up the quiet suburban road until Steve reached the T-junction with the high street. This was more brightly lit, and there were shops and businesses along the way. He looked to the right where the long straight road headed back into Manchester. There was a fair bit of traffic on the road, but still no sign of the van. He turned to the left, more traffic, a couple of black cabs and several buses, and there, just disappearing around the distant bend, a single black van. Steve gunned the bike and sped off in pursuit. The lazy Sunday evening traffic frustrated Steve's sense of urgency, but he maintained a decent speed as he wove his way past the intervening cars. He was closing quickly on the van when a bus pulled out right in front of him. With a heartfelt expletive, Steve hit the brakes hard. The bus had pulled out to get past a long row of parked cars, and now it stopped in the middle of the road, unable to pull into the curb and the people waiting at the bus stop. Steve made to go past, but there was a pedestrian island in the middle of the road, with two brightly lit bollards blocking his way, and the flow of oncoming traffic made it impossible to overtake on the other side of the road. He fumed and swore, and had no choice but to wait. By the time he got past the bus, the van was out of sight. The road ahead was clear for a while, and Steve accelerated close to 70 in the 30-mile-an-hour zone. When he rounded the bend, he could see the van once more. It was way out in front, beyond two sets of traffic lights, heading towards a series of roundabouts, where the killer could choose to take the motorway, a dual carriageway, or one of several small country roads. If Steve was going to lose him now, that would be the place. He maintained his reckless speed, weaving dangerously between the slower moving cars. The first set of traffic lights was accommodatingly green, but the second turned to red before he reached them. Steve dropped his speed, but he did not stop. He maneuvered past the waiting cars and threaded his way through the contraflow of traffic at the junction. He ignored the shouts and honking horns of irate drivers and did not notice the police car peeling away from the traffic and turning in pursuit of this dangerously irresponsible biker. Steve had lost sight of the van again. His eyes streamed from the cold wind in his face, and he blinked away the tears as he scanned the road ahead. Then he saw it. It was in the left-hand lane, rising up towards the first roundabout,
stuck in a line of slow-moving traffic, waiting to turn onto the dual carriageway. This was his chance to close the distance. He opened up the throttle, and the Kawasaki gave a throaty roar as it powered down the road. The wind was loud in his ears, but Steve slowly became aware of a police siren behind him. He glanced in his wing mirror to see the police car closing fast, the cars that had slowed him down now moving aside to let it pass. Steve ignored it. His thoughts were only for the black van and for the prisoner within. He closed rapidly on the van, and as he reached the back of the slow-moving line of traffic, he pulled onto the gravel verge running down the side of the road. The back wheel of the Kawasaki slid and skidded in the gravel as he advanced on the van, but he just needed to get ahead of it. Then he could block its path and tackle the driver. Lucifer was frustrated by the slowness of the traffic, but he had learned over the years to master his annoyance at the failings of the immaterial world. Impatience led to errors, and errors led to failure and confinement, and so he waited in the line of traffic, anticipating the service that would soon commence. The witness lay in the back of the van, quiet but for the odd snuffle and moan. Lucifer had been required to strike him a second time when they reached the van, harder this time, enough to quieten the witness until the time of his confession. A sudden flash of blue light in his wing mirror caught his attention. An agent of false justice. Lucifer looked to see if it had any bearing on him. It seemed not. It was some way back, although it was now driving on the gravel verge at the side of the road, seemingly in pursuit of a motorbike that was coming up fast on the inside. Lucifer glanced at the bike, and then he looked again, and the sudden flash of fury made his skin burn. It was the angel, the guardian angel of the witness, riding out to save his ward. But Lucifer would not have it. He let the traffic move away in front of him, opening up a gap. Then he turned the wheel to the left and lifted his great foot until the van's clutch engaged. He waited until the angel was almost level with him, and quickly lifted his foot. The van lurched into the bike's path, and Lucifer felt a satisfying crunch as the bike crashed into the side of the van. Had he been a fraction slower, Steve would have slammed right into the back of the van. As it was, he glanced off the side and went careering up a grassy bank and straight into a wooden fence. The bike was wedged against the broken fence, trapping his leg, and Steve tried desperately to free the bike as the black van drew away. The traffic ahead had opened up and the van drove steadily up towards the roundabout. Steve heaved against the bike and was just working his leg free when the police car skidded to a halt on the gravel behind him. Two policemen jumped out, and before Steve could regain his feet, they had rushed across to restrain him. Steve found himself sprawled across the front of the police car, his face pressed against the warm bonnet, and his hands snapped quickly into handcuffs.
"Just take it easy," said the policeman, holding him down when Steve tried to adjust his position.
He was trying to twist round so he could see the van, see which way it went.
"You don't understand," said Steve. "You have to stop that van." "You were driving like a maniac long before that van pulled out on you," said the policeman, without relaxing his grip on Steve. "Now, what's your name?"
Glancing in his mirror, Lucifer was gratified to see the angel being apprehended by the police. There was a certain pleasing irony in that. He watched as they hauled him across the front of the car.
"Farewell, guardian angel," he thought. "The witness is mine."
The chorus sang victorious. Steve watched despairingly as the van turned left onto the dual carriageway heading east. One of the police still held him down while the other sat half inside the car, the police radio in his hand.
"Relax," said the policeman, holding him. "We're just checking to see if we've run into you before."
Steve closed his eyes in the face of utter defeat.
"Simon," he thought. "Oh, God, Simon."
The policeman in the car was waiting for a reply.
"That's right," Steve heard him say. "Brenners, Stephen Brenners, 70, Court Farm Road."
"What is it?"
asked the colleague at the unusual delay. The policeman in the car did not answer at first. He held up his hand, listening. Then his eyebrows shot up and his mouth fell open. His face flushed visibly as he hung up the radio and stepped out of the car.
"What is it? What's going on?"
asked the policeman holding Steve. "Has he got a record?"
"No," said the other, reaching into his pocket for the key to the handcuffs. "He's got immunity. Class A transactional immunity."
The policeman's demeanor had changed completely. All possible assistance was the term they had used. Now they quickly helped him manhandle the bike down the grassy bank and back onto the road. It took several attempts to clear the carburetor and get it started, but finally it spluttered and coughed its way back into life. Steve read the engine as it found its feral voice.
"Is there anything else we can do?" asked the policeman over the noise.
"Yes," said Steve, as he turned the bike in the direction of the roundabout. "You can put out an alert for a black Mercedes van." The policeman nodded. "And then," said Steve, as the Kawasaki sent a hail of gravel flying against the police car, "you can stay the fuck out of my way." The massive bike powered away as Steve took up the chase once more. The van had vanished, but the dual carriageway was a long, straight road. And if he were quick, and if he were lucky, he might yet still find his friend.
Chapter 30.
How long had it been? Thought Steve. 4 minutes? 5?
It did not sound like much, but on a fast road like this, that could be 4 or 5 miles at least.
How far to the next junction?
He was not exactly sure. All he knew was that the junctions were few and far between. The only things he passed were small private side roads leading to big houses, farms, and there was one sign for a scrap metal yard and tip. Some of these smaller roads were to the left and some to the right, with short filter lanes allowing would-be users to cross the other side of the dual carriageway. Steve flicked glances left and right as he passed each driveway, but they were dark and unlit, and there was no sign of the van. He blazed down the road, doing upwards of 90 miles an hour. He streaked past the other vehicles, the cold wind tearing at his clothes and hair. But he did not feel the cold as he tried to control his mounting anxiety.
"Where are you? Where are you?"
The road climbed a small rise, and Steve remembered that the first junction lay a mile or so beyond. If he had not found the van by then, which road would he take? How would he decide? He shut away the doubts and screamed up the hill. And when he reached the top, his spirits rose. The traffic had come to a standstill, queuing all the way up to the junction almost a mile ahead. Nothing that had come through here in the last 20 minutes had passed through this jam. The van must still be there. Steve sped down the long slope and picked his way through the standing traffic, searching all the while for sight of the black Mercedes van. The first quarter mile, nothing. Halfway through and still no sign. Steve's heart felt like a heavy lump of stone as he reached the end of the traffic jam. The van was not there.
"I've lost him," thought Steve. "Oh God, I've lost him."
The bike idled impatiently as Steve sat astride it in the middle of the road. Cars honked at him, but he did not hear them. He was fighting to keep despair at bay.
Where did he go? Where the hell did he go?
Steve had definitely seen the van come out onto the dual carriageway, so where was it now?
"He must have turned off," concluded Steve.
That was the only answer. The killer must have turned down one of the private side roads. But which one? There was no way of knowing, and it was foolish to try and guess. Steve would have to check them all. Lucifer would waste no time with the witness. The light of Providence shone upon him. The sudden appearance of the guardian angel proved it so. He had thwarted the angel, but still he must act quickly. There would be no mistakes tonight. He locked the van in the barn, carried the witness into the chapel, and laid him at the foot of the altar. He took the short bladed fist dagger from the altar and cut off his clothes. Then, leaving the witness naked on the floor, he went to change. When he returned, the witness was starting to come round, shivering, and moaning round the wire gag in his mouth. Lucifer stood over him and began to pray. Steve crossed the central reservation through one of the gaps reserved for emergency vehicles. Now, heading back the way he had come, he pushed the bike as fast as it would go. The first turnoff was just back over the rise, on this side of the road. He would be there in less than a minute. "Private, no entry," the sign read, but Steve ignored it. He turned onto the rough track and switched the bike's headlamp to full beam, illuminating the twisting way ahead. The potholed track continued for perhaps 200 meters to an old cottage abandoned long ago. However, enclosing the cottage and the surrounding area was a high chain-link fence. The area inside had been cleared and covered with gravel and was filled with numerous large metal containers. Steve stopped in a wide puddle outside the heavy gate. A dog started barking and two big Alsatians loped into view, barking aggressively through the wire. The sign on the gate read, "No tipping, keep out," and Steve was not inclined to go any further. The gate did not appear to have been opened recently, and there was nowhere else for a van to go. He maneuvered the bike round and headed back to the road. Simon opened his eyes to a waking nightmare. The killer loomed above him, the tall, dark youth from his childhood, the stranger from the church, the constant terror of his dreams and waking hours, too. He was here. He was real. And Simon was at his mercy. Lucifer concluded his opening prayer and lowered his upturned hands. The witness had awakened. He could feel his eyes upon him. He looked down and the chorus rose up in fervent harmony. This is what he lived for. To humble such as he. Simon could not comprehend the lack of humanity in those dead, black eyes. His mind was blinded by the dark light of evil before him. Shrinking back against the hard stone floor, he tried to cry out, but found that he could not. Lucifer smiled at the fear in the witness's eyes. "So," he thought, "not so formidable after all, not so strong as we had thought." He turned his back on the witness and crossed to the wall of the chapel, to a wooden stand where he kept the rod and the staff. The witness would be quickly humbled. He would confess his sins, he would be cleansed, and he would die. Lucifer would take the breath of life from his lungs and dump his body in the ground like so much rancid meat. Simon tried to squirm away as the killer returned, arching his body like a worm. But the killer grabbed his legs and hooked his ankles over the end of one of the short pews. Simon was left with just his bare shoulders against the stone. His hands were tied securely behind his back. Naked and freezing, he felt horribly vulnerable and exposed. He watched as the killer lifted two long staves, one a brass crozier and one a wooden shaft that might once have held a cross. Both were battered and stained. The killer raised the staves and began to speak. "Yea, as you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you will fear my anger. For I am there with the rod and the staff. With the rod and the staff I humble thee." The killer's voice was deep and guttural, and possessed of a horrible melodic quality. And, as he ended his short perversion of scripture, he brought the staves down on Simon's naked form. Simon screamed as the thick brass rod smashed into his shins, the wooden shaft whacking down against his unprotected feet. He stared up with utter panic in his eyes. He could not move, he could not twist away. Over the years he had felt the torture again and again, but now he was here in the chapel of night, and in reality the pain was far, far worse. The rod and the staff, they rose and fell again, and again, and again. And Simon screamed. Steve had checked a farm and a track that led to a disused electricity substation. Now he followed another private road that was signposted "Private, Access Only," but a vehicle had driven down this track recently.
The splashes from the puddles along the way were still wet and shining in the Kawasaki's headlamp. Steve wondered if this were the place. God, he hoped it was. He followed the track round a broad curve and came upon a large house, with two big cars parked upon the gravel drive. One, an expensive-looking Audi, and the other a Range Rover, still wet from its splashing through the puddles on the track. The front door of the house opened, light spilled out, and several well-dressed adults emerged.
No, said one of the men, no trouble at all. Most people end up at the substation next turn down, said a woman, coming to help carry the bags from the back of the Range Rover.
Steve ground to a halt in the gravel. The people turned to look at him, a dour-looking man riding a big motorbike, no helmet and a face of fury.
Can I help you?
Asked one of the men, taking a step towards Steve. Steve ground his teeth and let out an animal growl.
No,
was all he said, and with that he spun the bike round and headed back to the main road.
Oh, God,
he thought, as he pulled back onto the dual carriageway. How long has it been? It must be 40 minutes now since he had last seen the van, maybe more. The killer could be anywhere. Steve was losing hope. He turned onto another private road with a sign saying Dryden Farm. The track rose up slightly and Steve could see the lights of farm buildings through the trees. It looked so homely and peaceful, but Steve could not afford to pass it by. He tore up the track, turned into the yard, and almost collided with a tractor reversing out of a barn. The bike slid sideways on a slick of mud and slurry, and Steve careered into a row of aluminium feeding troughs. The elderly farmer climbed out of the tractor and hurried over to Steve.
You're right,
he asked. I didn't see you there. You came in pretty fast.
Steve could not hide his disappointment and frustration. He was struggling to keep the bike upright in the slippery yard.
Easy there, said the farmer. Let me give you a hand.
Steve felt the bike steady as the farmer grabbed the pillion bars behind the seat. He pulled it backwards, allowing Steve to steer the bike away from the feeding troughs.
You lost? Asked the farmer, warily, when he saw the expression on Steve's face. I'm looking for a friend of mine, said Steve, as he tried to turn the bike around.
Oh, said the farmer.
He's in a black Mercedes van, said Steve.
The farmer paused for a second, thinking. Steve drew slowly forward, not wanting to accelerate too quickly on such a slippery surface. He was almost back on the road where the bike's tires could find some purchase and speed him away.
The Harper boy drives a black van, said the farmer,
and Steve came to a lurching halt, though I've never known him have a friend. Steve just stared at the farmer, his heart suddenly pounding excitedly in his chest.
The Harper boy, he said. Aye, said the farmer. Is that all you mean?
Big guy, said Steve, dark hair.
Bloody massive, more like, said the farmer. Aye, that's the fella.
So I've come up the wrong track, said Steve, trying not to sound too desperate for information.
Yep, said the farmer. You need to get back on the main road and turn left. Go up to the roundabout and come back down on the other side of the road. It'll be the third turning on your left, big pylon by the drive. The house is set back some way from the road.
Grim place now, he rambled on. Not what it was when Mr. Harper was around.
Mind you, he was an odd one, too, he gave Steve a knowing look.
Bible basher, if you know what I mean.
Steve could only stare at the farmer.
Do me a favor, he said. Call the police and tell them to get some people round there straight away.
Is something wrong? Asked the farmer.
Please, just do it, said Steve, as he kicked the bike into gear. Tell them Steve Brenner's told you to call.
And with that, he took off down the track like a man possessed. Indeed, he was a man possessed. Possessed of newfound hope.
Hang on, Simon, he implored. Hang on.
Chapter 31 Lucifer removed the wire gag and waited to see if the witness would wake unaided. He needed to be conscious before he could confess. He looked down at the pathetic figure lying on the flagstones before the altar. The battered flesh, the broken skin, the bright blood flowing from the ghostly whiteness of his body. There was something of beauty in that, at least.
He went over to the font, drew some water in the great bowl of his hands, and returned to stand over the witness once more. "Or don't you know," he whispered quietly, "that all who are baptized here are baptized into death?" The chorus approved of his words, the reference to scripture. Lucifer basked in the music of it as he let the water fall. It was fitting that he should rouse the witness with an act of aspersion. Simon gasped with the sudden shock of cold. The pain that had been dulled by stupor now assaulted him once more, steaming in wave after wave from his ravaged nerves. Through swollen eyes he looked up into the face of death as the killer reached down towards him. Lucifer took the witness by his arms and lifted him to his knees. The weakling was too feeble to bear his weight at first, but Lucifer took a fistful of his sodden hair and held him up until he found his strength. Then he nodded and went to bring the bucket and the aspergillum. Simon could not stop shaking, shaking from the cold and the pain, but more so from the fear. He knew what was coming next. With desperate eyes he watched the killer. He could not look away. The killer, in his altar clothes, his filthy, blood-stained altar clothes, a mockery of service to the church. He watched him and he could not look away. And when the killer turned, the silver bucket and the holy water sprinkler in his hand, Simon began to weep. How many times had he felt this before? How many times had he screamed his confession before the acid fell? Screamed it and meant it and believed that he had sinned, and prayed that he would be believed, that he might be spared the pain. But now that he was here, he wept. He wept because he knew he could not do it. He could not willingly confess. He could not lie, not in the face of such abhorrent lies. He could not give them credence. He would not. Not while any strength of will remained. God give him strength, he wished he could, but he could not. Lucifer returned to stand before the witness, and when he spoke, it seemed to be in answer to some unheard question. "With the sin of heresy," he said, "and with questioning the authority of those in dominion." He dipped the aspergillum and raised it to one side, the vitriolic fluid falling on the stone and burning it away. "He has dismissed the sublime rapture of the chorus and must confess." Lucifer looked down at the witness, and the witness met his gaze. The arrogance remained. There was defiance in him yet, but Lucifer watched as it melted away, running in rivulets from his eyes. "You will learn humility and you will die," thought Lucifer, as he cleared his mind to pray. "Do you confess to those in dominion," he began, "and to these, my brothers and sisters, that you have sinned, in your thoughts and in your words, in what you have done, in what you have failed to do? And do you ask the blessed chorus, ever present, and all the angels and saints and these, my brothers and sisters, to pray for you to those in dominion, that the Almighty might have mercy on you, forgive you your sins, and bring you to everlasting truth? Amen." The tears flooded down Simon's face, and every fiber of his being screamed at him to confess, to do whatever it took to escape the pain. But man is more than fiber, and he found that he could not. He drew a ragged, sobbing breath, and, "No," he softly said. The killer frowned and let the cleansing vial fall. Simon screamed a sinew-snapping scream, a scream to shred his lungs. The splashes of acid ate away at his skin, devoured his flesh and fizzed against his bones, burning worse than any fire. Pain enough to drive one mad. He collapsed onto his side, writhing and thrashing in agony.
"Yes," he screamed. "Yes, I confess."
Lucifer smiled. The cleansing had begun. Steve did not take the farmer's advice. He did not go up to the roundabout. He crossed straight over to the other side of the road, hugging the verge as he sped the wrong way down the inside lane of the dual carriageway. Coming from this direction, he was not sure which "the third turning on the left" would be, so he looked instead for an entrance with a big pylon beside it.
and there it was, just a few hundred meters ahead, a big electricity pylon beside yet another private road. Steve turned into the drive, skidding and bouncing along the poorly maintained driveway. The Kawasaki was not suited to such terrain, and he had to fight to keep it upright. Finally, a deep pothole proved too much, and the bike slid out from under him. He was sent sprawling across the road, but he scrambled up, immediately running back to the bike and heaving it upright. He made several attempts to get it started, but the engine would not bite. Shit, thought Steve, letting the bike fall back down. In the darkness ahead, he could make out the shape of buildings. Better just to run. The witness lay moaning in his own filth, his head resting on the flagstones, blood and drool